19th, 2007, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2575 and 2485. And Representative Bloom, we'll have Andy first talk about it, and Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'll quickly just summarize House Bill 2075 and 2485. House Bill 2575 would create a family leave benefits insurance program, which would provide benefits to employees taking family leave. It would require employees to pay premiums, which would be withheld from earnings into a family leave benefits insurance account. It would apply only to employers with 25 or more employees. It would establish qualifications for benefits and would also create an unlawful employment practice. House Bill 2485 would amend the Oregon Family Leave Act to allow employees to use paid accrued sick leave when taking family leave.
Thank you, Andy. Welcome, Representative Rosenbaum.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum from House District 43, Southeast and Northeast Portland, and thank you very much for holding hearings on both of these bills, which I think are extremely important to the families of Oregon. I'd like to talk first about House Bill 2575, which sets up the Oregon Family Leave Benefits Insurance Program. And I think that for a little background on this issue, you all probably are aware that Oregon has the earliest family leave laws in the entire country. In fact, our state family leave law became a model for the national FMLA, Family Leave Act, that was passed in Congress after ours had existed. And it's a great law, you know, that provides time off if you have a child, adopt a child, have a family member who's seriously ill, and for other purposes. The only problem is for a lot of people who are living paycheck to paycheck, they simply can't afford to take time off because they can't afford to go without a paycheck. And so that's what House Bill 2575 is designed to address. It will set up a program in Oregon modeled on one that already exists in California for people to have partial wage replacement when they take time off for the purposes that they're entitled to take family leave. Not for the whole 12 weeks that they're entitled to, but for up to 6 weeks. And certainly it won't replace the full paycheck, but we're looking at a benefit of around $250 a week that would help people pay the bills while they're taking time off the job. In California, this law passed a few years ago, and to date, more than 137,000 people in California have been able to take advantage of it. In our neighboring state of Washington, they also have a bill like this moving through their process, and I was very excited to hear just last week that their bill had passed the state Senate in Washington and now is scheduled for hearings in the House this week. So we believe that that's looking very promising and is moving ahead. We think this bill really is the ultimate win-win. We think that businesses and workers both benefit from it, as well as certainly from the families who are meant to receive the care and protection. We know already that there's turnover in businesses when people have a need to stay home and really can't afford to take time off, and in some cases have to go on public assistance as an alternative to being able to keep their jobs. Well, that's not good for employers. It's certainly not good for the families themselves, and this will enable them not to have to make that extremely painful choice between their job and their family. We think that people should be able to have a family and be able to work and to support their family, and this is a step in that direction. I also want to stress that you have some written testimony from Julie Young, which should be in your bill file or in the process of being distributed. Julie Young is the head of the Portland City Club's Committee on Work and Families, and they issued a report and have looked at the option of paid family leave as one of the things that could address some of the problems that they see. And as you know, the City Club of Portland is a business-oriented organization, so we're very pleased to have Julie Young's testimony in support of the bill. In addition, and particularly in the last few days, I have been really besieged with emails from people, particularly mothers, who are saying we really need a law like this in Oregon that we think would really help us out, and that they're very excited that you are hearing the bill today. So for all of those reasons, I'm very pleased to be here in support of the bill, very grateful that you're holding hearings on it, and I'm sure you will get other testimony too, but I would really urge you to look favorably on this bill. So that's House Bill 2575. I also want to talk about House Bill 2485. And I know at least one of your committee, actually more than one of your committee members, is a co-sponsor of this bill. So House Bill 2485 addresses what I think is somewhat of an oversight in our existing Oregon Family Leave Act. Right now, you can take paid vacation time, if you have it, to help defray the cost when you're taking time off under OFLA. But you're not allowed to take paid sick time except for one instance, and that is the birth of a child. We think that's really kind of odd because the other purposes for which you're taking time off really do address illness, and yet if you have paid sick time, you're not allowed to use it for those purposes. So this bill simply would change that and say that, because right now the law says that it's up to the employer basically whether to let you use it or not. This would just say that if you have accrued paid sick time, you're allowed to use it for your Oregon Family Leave Act time off. And we think, like the companion bill we're talking about today, it also will address people who really can't afford to take time off but need to be with somebody who's dying in some cases or bond with a child. And so we think that it's an extremely important bill as well and would urge you to support it. And I would be happy to answer any questions on either bill.
Question? I have a question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Good morning, glad you're here.
Good morning.
And I'm interested in cost to business, and I noticed on both the written yours and Julie Young's. Tell me a little bit more about the sources that show very encouraging sort of offset for business in terms of productivity and so forth.
Yeah, and Julie actually, unfortunately, is out of town and couldn't be here this morning, so we can certainly get you an answer to that question, and I will also have to get back to you on the answer to your question. I think in terms of the funding mechanism, and I should have stated this in my testimony, that the funding for the paid family leave program is a small cents per hour that will be paid exclusively by the employees, so the employer will not have to pay that at all. In fact, in California, when they first proposed this, they had an equal contribution from employers and employees, and eventually to get it passed, they dropped the employer contribution, and so we modeled ours on their existing program. But as to your other question, I will get that information to you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kotick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
Rosenbaum. Thank you for bringing both these bills forward. I just want to say one thing that might be of help to the committee is I've seen some statistics, and I'm not sure who puts them out. They might be CBS or Employment Department, but the number of employees in the state who don't even have paid sick leave. I think many of us would be shocked by that. I've been very fortunate. I can't even recall any of the jobs I've ever had when I didn't even have, I've had paid sick leave. That is not the case for many folks in the state. And so the idea of allowing some kind of partial payment when you have to take care of a family member or an illness of your own is really incredibly important. So if we can get that information from Consumer and Business Services, I think people will be shocked to see how many employers at various sizes do not provide paid sick leave at all.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotick, that's a great point. I think that the statistics I've seen are roughly a third don't have it, and if you look at low-wage workers who are certainly going to be more affected by this, it's much higher than that. So I think it would really help in those cases.
Thank you. Representative Nowak, did you have a question?
Yes. On 2575, it appears that this is essentially a tax on employees. And so does this require three-fifths of our body to pass it?
Well, that's, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I would call it more a contribution. I don't know the answer to that question. That's a really good question, though, and we can certainly check with legislative counsel. Normally, when there is a bill that has that threshold, they will state on the bill that it's a revenue-raising bill that requires a three-fifths vote. They did not put that on this bill, so I will certainly, if there's not somebody in the audience today that has an answer to that, we will check with legislative counsel. They may even be monitoring your hearing right now, and often they pop up when questions like that arise, so I'm sure we can find the answer.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess that's a follow-up, Representative Rosenbaum, of what my counterpart down the other end asked. So we don't know whether or not this would move toward revenue then?
You know, I don't believe it has a subsequent referral on it. Your staff may be able to check that in the computer, but I don't think it does right now, and I actually suspect that it probably was not considered to meet the threshold that would require what we're talking about. It's not an, I mean, it's certainly not, well, I don't know. I think we should just get the answer to that and not speculate about it. So we'll check it out.
I have a follow-up, if it's...
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed you used the word contribution, and on page 5, line 24, it says the employee may elect. I don't know if that's the out. It allows, since it's a voluntary, if it is a voluntary contribution, it wouldn't be a tax. I offer that to whatever.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, and I think that what you're looking at actually refers to people having the option to have federal income taxes deducted from the benefits that they're entitled to
if they're
covered by this program. So I think that it's still an open question that we'll have to get an answer to. The other thing, though, that reminded me of is that it's important to stress that the people covered by 2575 are the same people that are covered by the Oregon Family Leave Law. We thought it was important for administration and, you know, so there wouldn't be an undue impact on businesses to have it be the same threshold. So you have to work for an employer that has at least 25 employees, which means that the smaller businesses than that, you would not be entitled to time off. In other states, actually, including California, where this started, and I think also in Washington, where it's proposed, they're covering everybody. So, you know, there certainly would have been that option, but we chose not to go down that road because we thought we might hear from small businesses that were worried about it. And so although, you know, we have certainly heard from lots of people who work for those smaller businesses who still have problems and feel like they need help, this bill right now does not address that. So. Representative Cowan and then Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum, too. Could we move over to 2485? I find this interesting that, if I heard you correctly, it's an employer's option at this point as to whether or not they let the employees paid sick leave as part of their family medical leave. My experience as an employer at the county level was that we did encompass all of those various kinds of leaves in our family medical leave. So I guess I'm just curious, your research find that a number of employers choose not to allow the use of sick leave when someone is using family medical leave?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Kelly. And we do have the Bureau of Labor and Industries who will be, Labor Commissioner Sarah will be testifying. My guess is he can probably answer that question much better than I can, but we certainly have heard from lots of people who are not being allowed. And I should clarify, too, that the one exception to that would be in the case of the birth of a child, you are currently entitled to use it. So that's the only instance in which you are.
Thank you. Representative Mallory, did you have a question?
I did. In the 25 employee limit, and this is in 2575, I guess I see that level as somewhat arbitrary, and so employees that work for businesses that have fewer than 25 employees can't contribute or don't contribute?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Miller. Right now, the reason we picked that threshold was because we were modeling this on the Oregon Family Leave Act. And the Oregon Family Leave Act, and I think this happened quite intentionally, did pick a 25-employee threshold. In fact, it was when Senator Gordon Smith was president of the state Senate that he oversaw an expansion of our Family Leave Act to cover those employers between 25 and 50. In other states, like California, they have everybody covered. Even self-employed people have the option of paying into the fund and then getting the benefit of it. And that certainly would be a possibility. I would certainly not be opposed to any amendments that you might think were appropriate to this bill to cover people who worked for smaller employers. But we simply thought that as an initial proposal, it might be better to start with the same threshold so that we didn't meet objections from those that weren't covered by the law right now. So I think it would be great if you wanted to amend the bill.
Well, no, you completely misinterpreted the question. The question was, is employees that worked in companies less than 25 could not contribute to this under this current bill?
I mean, if they, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, I mean, if would they have the option of contributing to it?
I can't, I guess, sorry. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have an option, because if you don't work for an employer that has 25 or more employees, mm-hmm. then you can't take money from the fund, so you certainly can't contribute money to mm-hmm. the fund. At least that's how it appears to me. And I see this as kind of an artificial cap. I mean, if I'm an employer and I have my employees and I say, well, you know what, when we hit this 25 threshold, there's a series of laws that take effect at that threshold. So, you know, we have to make a decision, employees and its management, and make a decision as whether or not we want to expand, because there's a cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, I see this, you know, it can be couched in many words, but it's still, it's a tax on the employees that they pay, and many of the employees are probably never going to see any benefit from it, so.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I suppose you could see it that way. I guess to me, though, it's such a small amount. The benefit is so huge that, and I think, too, you know, whether people might immediately be partaking of the time off or not, ultimately, every one of us is probably going to face the situation of an aging parent or a spouse or somebody who needs our time and care. And so I think, you know, if you think about it on a little larger plane, really ultimately everybody will benefit from this. And I think that that's something that most people would see as affecting them too. Plus the fact that when people take time off now, you know, their coworkers are picking up the slack. I think that people are often at work when they really need to be home and are very worried about the family member that they need to be taken care of, and so that ultimately it would be better for everybody to have them able to take some limited time off and be able to do what they need to do and not have to make that very painful choice.
Representative Gelcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum. In Representative Maurer's question, I understood part of the question to be that employees from employers with less than 25 employees would be prohibited from benefiting from or contributing to. But I'm wondering if that's addressed on page 4, mm-hmm. line 8, stating that an employer of employees not covered by this section or a self-employed person may elect coverage under the Family Leave Benefits Insurance Program for an initial period of not less than 3 years. And then it goes on to talk about how they would make that contribution and that not the Labor Commissioner, but the Bureau of Labor and Industries could remove them from the program if they were not remitting their payment. Is that true that these small employers or individually employed individuals would be able to proactively elect if they so chose to participate in the program?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelster, I think you're right. And in fact, it looks like it's the employer or the self-employed individual who would make that choice. So it would really be up to the employer. An individual worker who might want to participate would have to convince their employer to do that unless they were self-employed. So you're right, though, that certainly is an option under this program, so perhaps that does address some of Representative Maurer's concern. Thank you for pointing that out.
What's the protest?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up with that, that's because that's the mechanism of how we're collecting the funds. I mean, the employer, it's a payroll tax, so they need to be bought into it, I would assume.
Right, but they, Madam Chair, Representative Kochek, they really are setting up the payroll deduction aspect, but they're not paying the money.
So they're just doing the payroll
deduction. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rosenbaum, just one really simple question. Through your research on this, and I'm referring to your letter testimony that you gave us. You mentioned that more than 137,000 Californians took advantage of this program the first year. Did your research reveal any positives or negatives from the business perspective?
You know, Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we really have not heard complaints about the California program. We did a lot of discussing and contacting the people down in California to see how it was working. I think the one thing that they found is that they had projected a higher rate of people taking time off than currently have, and that may be because the program's relatively new and people don't know that they're entitled to it. So I think they were somewhat surprised by that too, but I think, you know, in answer to your question, we really didn't find a lot of complaints about it. So.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And next we have Commissioner Dan Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Let me first start with House Bill 2485. To just give you a bit of a brief history of Oregon family leave law, Oregon did take an early leadership role in developing law related to family and medical leave. Many components of Oregon's law were subsequently enacted at the national level by the federal government in 1993. Prior to 1988, Oregon employers were not required to provide time off to employees for family medical leave, nor were there any deferral family leave mandates. As long as non-discriminatory policies and practices were followed, employers were really free to choose on their own whether they would grant the leave of the employees. Unfortunately, it really resulted in an uneven treatment, including termination of many workers. And the 1987 Oregon legislature recognized that parents needed the right to develop strong family bonds without the fear of job loss or sacrifice of employment opportunities, and they enacted the parental leave law, requiring larger employers of 25 or more employees to provide workers with time off to care for newborn and newly adopted children. This law was followed in 89, requiring employers to allow pregnant workers to transfer to a less strenuous job or take time off during pregnancy if it's medically necessary. The Oregon Family Leave Law was enacted in 91 to provide workers with job-related protection to care for health conditions of family members. And in 1993, the federal government adopted the Family and Medical Leave Act, commonly known as FEMLA, which applies to employers with 50 or more employees. In 1995, the Oregon legislature sought to streamline the state's leave law and reduce administrative burden on employers who are covered by a myriad of separate leave laws, and the legislature made statutory changes to simplify those laws. This was accomplished by repealing the parental leave, pregnancy leave, and family medical leave laws in Oregon, and instead adopting the Oregon Family Leave Act, commonly known as OFLA. As any of the agency that enforces the law, I view House Bill 2485 as a vehicle to streamline OFLA and make the various forms of leave consistent in terms with workers' rights to utilize paid sick leave while on job protective leave. Currently, the right to use accrued sick leave is afforded only to those employees taking parental leave. For all other forms of family leave, such as sick child or needing to care for a seriously ill family member, the right to use accrued sick leave is at the discretion of the employer. For House Bill 2575, really see this one as a giant step forward. One of the things we see is oftentimes people don't take as much or as often family leave as is necessary for their family because they literally can't afford it. By creating a system where there could be pay for that through their own payroll deduction, I can see where this is be very useful to a lot of families. And quite frankly, a benefit to the state. If you have, an ill spouse, parent, who's terminally ill, to be able to care for that person, is a very tiring but yet rewarding experience for most people I've talked to who have gone through it. It's healing for families. It's less costly to the state through other social services. It's less costly to insurance companies. And it's
you know, not only a financial but a human benefit as well. I think by having this type of protection, we will strengthen families across the state of Oregon, as they've been able to do in California or starting to do in the state of Washington. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Did you wish to add anything? Okay, any questions?
She promises not to say anything if you don't ask any questions.
Well,
I could answer it. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm only kidding.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Clare, and I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I'd like to answer Representative Cowan's question. It may not be definitive, but I can say anecdotally that we do get inquiries from individuals who want to be taking family leave and would like to use their sick leave, and they cannot because it is the employer's policy, and a number of employers have policies that your sick leave is just for your own sickness, not for that of a family member.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Olson.
Oh, all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gardner, I don't know if you've been paying attention closely to what California's been doing with 25 cents, the similar bill of 2575, but I guess I want to pose the same question to you from your observation of what I did to Representative Rosenbaum, for the positives as well as the negatives on businesses down there.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we haven't been following as closely to be able to tell you in individual things. I can tell you that it's, you know, if you think of it in a human perspective, I can think of several positive benefits to employers. I mean, stop and think about it. If you had a parent that was dying or a child that was very, very sick, how productive an employee you might be if your mind is totally concentrated on that. If you can take the time off, go spend the time to nurse the person back to health, or in more unfortunate circumstances, to the end of their life and care for them, I think you would come back a much more productive employee. I know in my own situation with my employees, I just had an employee go through that. She lived with her mother for several years. They lived together and has just returned back to work a few months ago. And by having the time off that she needed and being able to be covered by the sick leave the state provides, I think she's come back much more productive than she has, you know, before she left.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in, thanks both for being here. I'm interested in maybe your response to, currently, I think the language here in your testimony is employers have the, at their discretion, can now provide this. But then I think you hinted that maybe a significant number, it's not a matter of just tipping their hand in discretion, they're actually putting policies that say they will not allow this kind of leave. Is that significant, or am I accurate there?
Well, actually, Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, we really don't have statistics or keep statistics on how significant it is or isn't. I think what Ms. Clare was saying is that we've had a few cases where they haven't, where it's come up in those civil rights cases on also protected leave. But again, it's a matter of being a patchwork quilt, just as some of the laws were in the past. There's unequal treatment. And until you're facing the situation, I seriously doubt that most workaday employees would look in their employer's policy on this to know whether they could or could not use sick leave until one's facing them. And when it faces them, that's when they need it. There are clearly employers who do not, and clearly employers, as Representative Cowan mentioned, the county that she comes from, and I know the state of Oregon does. But as far as private employers, how many do or don't, I don't know if anyone keeps statistics. We can say anecdotally we've seen some that don't.
Any further questions? Thank you both very much. I'll call up Lisa Senders, Brenna Lopez, I believe it is, and Betty Haas. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Dr. Lisa Senders, and I'm an attorney, a psychologist, and a former professor at Wayne University. And I'm researching the impact of managing work and family, the equation. Where I've interviewed dozens of Oregon women and how they cope with the juggling demands of both. And in the process of this research, I've been forced to examine the multiple demands and pressures placed upon working mothers in today's economy. And I know we're talking about all workers here, and I want that expanded here, but my specific research has been devoted to working mothers. And some interesting statistics that we see in this bear very much on what we're talking about today. 71% of mothers who work have children less than 18 years of age. 57% of mothers who work have children less than 3 years of age. We're seeing a shift now. And some interesting statistics that we see in this bear very much on what we're talking about today. 71% of mothers who work have children less than 18 years of age. 57% of mothers who work have children less than 3 years of age. We're seeing a shift now demographically. The percentage of working mothers who have infants has actually decreased from 59% to 55% from 1998 to 2002. Only 13% of companies, and I think Representative Gillen asked this question, offer paid maternity leave, not specifically maternity, but actually offer paid leave. So that might help us look at who really is being compensated during these times of leave if they take them. What I started looking at was professional women, because I saw tremendous dropouts in attorneys, physicians, professors. And then I began to think, well, these are women who at least typically are married to individuals or are working in a higher income phase. So I was looking at what about the other end of the spectrum, not just the other end, but the whole spectrum. And what you're finding is with the median income of individuals and households, it's very difficult nowadays to keep up with the median cost of a house, let alone the regular, the other things that one must pay for just to live. So coupled with these costs, then to have to take time out with that being paid is basically not affordable to most individuals in the state. Few people have the choice, quote, to opt out. The impact of a sick child and a family member overwhelmingly falls upon women. In terms of health, this results in what we now know as 2 hours less of sleep for working mothers than the rest of the population. They have increased cortisol levels that for a working male or for a non-working mother, their cortisol levels, which is a stress hormone, drops during night when they sleep. For working mothers, it doesn't drop. So very interesting biological impact from their continued stress and demands. During those first few months of a child, you all know, they don't sleep. The child sleeps, gets up, wants to be fed. These women are sleep deprived. There is a time for bonding, and these women that I've interviewed feel constantly torn between wanting to be the best employees and employers that they can be, but also being the moms that they want to be. In my personal experience, in terms of what this means in terms of employment and the effect it has, just with tenure-track professors, the best predictor of not attaining tenure is to have a child, be a female with a child less than 5 years of age. I worry that a son who's just married a Swedish woman, once they have children, these are both high-powered engineers, she graduated the top of her class, I feel that they may go back to Sweden because they have benefits that take care of family. And I think we now have research that shows that it is a benefit to business to have these kinds of family policies that allow for the caring of family members. And not only does it increase productivity in the studies, there's enormous amount of studies done out there. And John Williams is an attorney now down at Berkeley. There have been 25 years of these studies that show that productivity increases actually when these kinds of leave policies are in place, as well as increased morale for the workers. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. Voluntary paid leave is very slow. I do think it has to come from the legislature, and I really appreciate the fact that this is being addressed here in Oregon. And we do have other people that have done it, other states that have done it. Certainly every other Western country in the world is doing something like this, and it is time for the United States to get on board. And I believe that it will help decrease the volatile instability of the economic picture that many families experience in this state. And as was testified to earlier,
very few companies are required to even provide sick leave. So thank you very much for entertaining this bill, and I hope it passes.
Thank you. Did you give us written testimony?
I did not.
I might have a book. That's why. If you have written notes, it would be just really helpful for us to have it in our files. So if you have them written out, and just give them to our staff, and we can make copies of them and give them right back to you. If you have it, if it's...
I'll polish that.
All right. Thanks so much. And I forgot to remind folks at the beginning. Could you please take out your cell phones and blackberries and blueberries and turn them all off? It affects the electronics in the room even when they're on, even when they're on mute. So if you could please turn them off, I would appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I'm going to ask if there's questions for you.
Actually, I do. I have a question about making correlations. I mean, we tend to make causal relationships when in fact they're not really there. And I'm wondering how in California this has been in place. I don't know how long it's been in place in California, but is there research to say that the family leave benefit program causes less stress in their life? They get a financial reward, but the burdens of parenting are 24/7, 365 until the day you pass away. So I don't see that necessarily is going to reduce stress levels.
The first 4 months developmentally, if you look at infants from a developmental psychologist standpoint, and you see the disruption in sleep patterns, the increased cortisol levels in working mothers, particularly during those times in the sleep deprivation, it's pretty crystal clear to me that that particular time that we're talking about here, the first 6 weeks, that's a particularly vulnerable time. The first 4 months, actually, from a developmental standpoint, if we're not looking at this bill, if we were just talking to the psychologist, I would say to you, during those first 4 months, you've got a much more vulnerable individual, or set of individuals, the child as well as the parent. And so the correlation in terms of stress, I'm not sure how to pinpoint your question, but I'd like to answer it if I haven't.
Well, I think that making a causal relationship between receiving a benefit check and reduced cortisol levels, I don't see that you're going to be able to make a causal relationship there.
I think the reality of receiving a paycheck for the first 6 weeks to 3 months versus not receiving a paycheck for half the people in Oregon would have a very strong impact on their reported level of stress, whether you measure the biological levels of cortisol is another issue. But I strongly suspect that if you asked an individual if you had to work during that time or not, and you could receive benefits, of partial benefits of your pay, most people would elect to take that, I would suspect, if it wasn't penalized by the employer.
Any further questions of this speaker? Thank you so much. You know what, I'm going to, if you wouldn't mind stepping down, and I'm going to invite this mother back here, who baby has been wonderful, but only it's time limited. Jessie Henderson, is that correct?
Yes.
Jessie, would you ladies mind if she spoke before you?
Not at all.
That's great. Jessie, come on up.
Okay, here we go.
I think that's
she's only attached at the moment.
Here we go. We have a breastfeeding bill, too.
Which I'm grateful for. So, for the record, my name is Jessie Henderson, mom of two boys, 3 and 3 months. Over the weekend, this is Juna Henderson, who will be testifying as well. I also represent an invisible force. I'm here also on behalf of Moms Rising, of which we have thousands of members in Oregon. Mother Tree Birth, I'm a birth doula, so I work with hundreds of moms each year that deal with this particular issue directly. In answer to the last question, two things that came up for me with regard to mom stress levels, which is something we work with. I think there are two areas in which we could look at that. One is breastfeeding issues, looking at the rates of breastfeeding in Oregon. We have one of the highest in the country. However, you can see a direct correlation when women go back to work that breastfeeding drops off. So in terms of one area of health and stress, I think that would be one concern that we'd look at. Also looking at mom's postpartum depression. It's the most common thing that affects women today in terms of an intervention in their pregnancy and postpartum experience. And we see women every day that are directly affected. I myself, my son turned 3 months over the weekend, and we're talking about a bill right now that only affects even the first 6 weeks for the lucky few that work for a company that has 25 employees or more. I was one of those women till my second pregnancy and had to leave that job because I held 3 jobs and had to make the hard choice of leaving the one job that actually would have provided me that benefit throughout the pregnancy. I feel this is very, very important, and this is a very small step if you look at the perspective of what other countries are providing, if you look at this perspective of what families and how they're impacted. It's a very, very hard choice for women today to even say, here's a 3-month-old baby, and say, now I must hand this baby off to be cared for by somebody else, that I'm ready to go back to work. Today would be my first day back at work if I wasn't self-employed. I have a very strong interest also for being able to contribute to this bill if it passes as a self-employed mom. There's many, many, many women. We have an organization in Portland that already has hundreds. Women make choices to actually become self-employed just to balance the work-life balance needs that we have with our children. So we can take them with us, leave them for a shorter period of time, being able to look at how we can actually manage these things. I would highly endorse for the hundreds of women that were actually telling me and emailed me personally and said, well, they would be all invisible forces behind us, but they couldn't take their sick leave day to come down here this morning because they had to reserve that for the time that they actually needed it for their children. Or they had a sick child at home today, or could not take the time away. I'm lucky that I had this perspective because I am actually able to do this on behalf of my work for the women that I work with, as well as for my family. So that's all I have to share today. And the other bill that I had just learned about, too, which I think is an addition to this, that I would highly recommend that support as well for families. I think it makes sense that a family would be able to also be able to stay home for their children. We show records that have women that are able to see that their babies get better well when their parents are with them faster. And if we're really caring about our children, if we're really caring about our families, this reason we have these kinds of supports, it's kind of a no-brainer. If I feel like I can stay into this and I can get out of it, and nobody else is impacted other than the people that are receiving to pay in. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Henderson. Any questions of this witness? Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, ladies.
Thank you. My name is Brina Lopez, and I'm here on behalf of the League of Women Voters. I'm actually kind of sitting in for Kathy Eaton today, and I would just really like to submit this testimony on behalf of the League. I won't read it all to you, but just say that we think that House Bill 2575 is a real win-win for Oregon's workforce and for Oregon's families. And as a personal aside, I was really responding to what the professor was saying as a working mom myself, and as a former legal aid attorney who had to go back to work at 10 weeks of my first son's birth for financial reasons, even as an attorney who had a husband with a good job. It's a real thing for real families, and I would have loved to have had when my babies were born. So thank you for this opportunity to submit this for the record.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, excuse me. Good morning, Karen DeLay and committee. I am Betty McChesney House, and I represent the American Association of University Women, or AAUW of Oregon. We're in favor of House Bill 2575, which provides for up to 6 weeks of paid leave after the birth of a baby and adoption of a child, or if a new child enters the family, as well as when a family member is seriously ill and needs care. The American Association of University Women has long supported flexible workplace policies to address the family responsibilities of employees. AAUW worked from 19... 19- 1933 to 1992, on the passage of the Family and Medical Leave Act, FMLA, which was finally signed into law in 1993. On May 27, 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think I left that, FMLA helps employees balance the increasing demands of work and family at a little or no cost to employers. FMLA allows eligible women and even men who work for employers with 50 or more employees to take up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave each year for certain family and medical purposes. Specifically, employees may use FMLA leave when they are seriously ill or when they must care for a newborn or adopted child or a seriously ill member of their immediate family. Employees receive continued health benefits while on leave and are granted same or equal position to the one they held prior to their leave. More than 35 million people who have covered are covered and eligible employees have used FMLA to take part of themselves, to care of themselves and their families during times of critical need without jeopardizing their health benefits or job security. And I have ones, twos, and threes in there, and my statistics come from the Department of Labor. I'm sorry I didn't put that in the bottom. However, 78% of eligible employees who have needed FMLA-covered leave have not been able to take it because they could not afford it. 90% of the employers said that complying with MLA brought little or no increase in their administrative costs. In fact, some employers have even reported that FMLA enhanced productivity, lowered employee turnover, and improved morale. States also expressed an interest in building on the success of FMLA. In 2002, 27 states introduced a range of proposals that would provide partial paid leave for workers, allowing them to balance their work and family responsibilities. In particular, California became the first state to pass a paid leave bill into law. In September 2002, Governor Gray Davis signed into law legislation that would allow employees to take time off from work to care for a newborn, or newly adopted, or newly placed foster child, or a seriously ill family member. Employees would have access to up to 6 weeks of partially paid leave per year, during which time they would be able to earn up to 55 to 60% of their wages. This new program would expand the state fund that provides insurance for disabled workers and is funded by employee payroll deductions. However, gratifying it is to see these advances that spotlight the importance of the family in our country. It is time for Oregon to take that next step and pass House Bill 2575. This bill tells our citizens that family is important to all Oregonians. After all, we led the nation in enacting the first parental and medical leave laws. This bill will give those families that have been unable to take advantage of operators' endeavors because they simply could not afford to lose the money, the ability to have partial wage and replacement. This proposal will enable many low-income families, particularly women, to be at home during the first months of life that are crucial for bonding. The law will also allow an employee to take care of a family member that has a life-threatening illness, providing essential service for families that are struggling with a situation like this. We therefore support House Bill 2575, and we're looking forward to its passing. And I would like to add one other thing on the other bill. I have been a teacher, and we were allowed sick leave. We had 10 sick leave days a year and 3 personal leave days a year. And that sounds like a lot until you have a family member in another state or a crisis come up that has to be taken care of immediately. 3 days is really a short period of time. And then you're told, well, I suppose if you have to, you could use your sick leave. So you end up calling in every day saying, I'm sick, which isn't really true. I guess emotionally you're sick because you have to take care of someone else and you're lying. So it's you know, setting up a false pretense. So it would be absolutely a wonderful idea to pass that one also. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I see another mother with a child. Are you signed up to?
No, I just wanted to work with
you. Okay. Thank you. And Tom Chamberlain? J.L. Wilson and Lisa Chess, why don't you come up also? Go ahead, Tom.
around it.
It's an interesting panel.
Yeah.
Chair Tourmaine, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chamberlain, and I'm the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. You know, working families today look a lot different than they did 20, 25 years ago. Everybody works in a family, both parents, sometimes two, three jobs just to get by. We support HB 2485 and 2575 because we spend less and less time with our kids because we're working so hard. And when they're sick, what they need is a parent to take care of them. When your parent is sick, what they need is their child to take care of them. This is, we ask a lot of working people in this state. And this is a small price to pay to maintain family values, which we all profess we support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Chamberlain? Thank you so much. A nice speech yesterday, Mr. Chamberlain.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is J.L. Wilson. I represent NFIB. My comments today are on House Bill 2575, not 2485. We are not supportive of House Bill 2575, and I want to make it clear it's not because the current iteration of the bill is particularly bad. It's just that we believe that this current iteration will not stand the tests and pressures of time. And I wanted to get into any body of work that had been done surrounding the California law, because I think it's instructive to learn from experiences of other states. And admittedly, there's not a lot, but there is a small amount. And I came across a study done by Claremont McKenna University that was actually done to support the notion of paid family leave, but in doing so, it highlights our concerns quite succinctly. The issue raised by the Claremont McKenna study, which was a study of 400 family leave participants in Southern California 1 year after benefits were able to be collected, which was July of 2004, and the study was conducted in the winter of 2005. What the study said was, whereas more than 95% of our sample survey said that they felt positive or very positive about the program, that utilization or intended utilization was only about 1%. And the reason that 1%, as you know, the California law required 6 weeks at about 55% of salary. And the survey concluded that 52% of the respondents said that 55% of their salary was just not enough to live on, or they would lose money by taking the family leave. Only 8% stated that they were satisfied with that particular reimbursement. And the other 40% provided other reasons for not taking advantage of the benefit, including the reports that their workload would pile up at work, or perhaps that work was an outlet for them from their caregiving situation, and they actually valued going to the workplace. But the bottom line is, I feel that it feeds into our point. This bill, in its current iteration, is not going to provide a substantial enough benefit to be utilized. And the pressures of where do you go from that point? Are you going to tax employers' payroll, and employers at that point will say, well, you're taxing my payroll to provide a program that pays somebody to take absence from work. Or are you going to tax workers more? I'm not sure that anything beyond a penny per hour would please a lot of workers. So we are in a situation now where the current iteration of the bill is not that bad. It's where we go from the current iteration that gives us pause as it pertains to this program. So,
thank you, Mr. Wilson. Any questions of Mr. Wilson? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with the Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here today also in opposition to House Bill 2575, and concur with the comments that Mr. Wilson made about the concern of how the concept will morph over time. I think that the family leave, Oregon family leave, is an excellent example of that. It was intended to be unpaid time off, and we have a bill up today that would require employers to pay out the sick pay if their employees have accrued it, whether it would be for a reason that they typically pay sick pay for or not. So it's an expansion in that direction that concerns us. Also, it's my understanding, based on the status report, that this bill has a referral to the Revenue Committee. And it appears some of the questions that you asked of Representative Rosenbaum were excellent questions, and one of the things is I don't see that the tax collection is limited to employers with employees, 25 or more employees. I see where the benefit is allowed only for people who qualify under family leave, but if you look at page 5, I think it is, it says each employer shall withhold from the earnings of each employee. I don't see it limited to only each employer with 25 or more employees will withhold it. Although earlier on it does indicate that in order to receive the benefit. So it appears, at least the way it's written, that everybody would pay for it whether they were able to utilize it or not. The other thing is that I'm not sure that the Bureau of Labor and Industries is the appropriate agency to administer an insurance-type program. It seems that this is a... I'm not sure what the fiscal impact would be for them to assume it or if it's going to be taken out of that penny per hour, thereby reducing available funds for workers that might want to... utilize the program. The other thing is that we've heard some comments today from a variety of people about the benefits that family leave has provided to employers. And from my membership's perspective, the reconciling of the federal law with the Oregon law is one of the most administratively burdensome programs they deal with, and we hear about it daily from members who are concerned. Some of my members have taken the time to look at. We can't control how many employees are off at any one time. If we have over 25 employees and people request, they get the time off. We can't control how many are out at any one time. So you also have the overtime issues for people, and then that gets into a whole different bill that Bureau of Labor and Industries introduced about overtime. But part of that overtime is caused because people who are left at work are still there because other people have left for family leave. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wilson and Ms. Trussell, for being here. I really appreciate the business perspective on this. So what I'm hearing is, from Mr. Wilson, it doesn't sound like it goes far enough. Like, it's unclear if it would have the effects that we're trying to have. Is that a fair assessment of what you're saying?
Thank you, Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek. My point being... With the survey, that 95% of the people felt good about it. 1% of the potential people actually got into the program. With a penny per hour here in Oregon, you'll fund a benefit that I don't think will make a real tangible difference. And then the question is, where do you go from there? Are you going to tax workers more, or are you going to implement a payroll tax on employers? If you're going to implement a payroll tax on employers, then employers, it's going to raise their hackles. And I can't possibly imagine on the employee side that they would subscribe to a huge tax increase for something that very few would access. And so it's where we go from this initial starting point. Do I believe the initial starting point is inadequate for purposes of achieving what it's intended to do? Yeah, absolutely. But it's where you go from here that really causes problems, at least for my members.
Thank you.
Okay, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I get the point around morphing into something bigger. I guess I'd like to switch gears just a quick second. And has either of your organizations looked at workplace leave policies and in terms of competitiveness, worker retention? Because one could argue that some of the employers who are out there who do provide more flexible leave, more of the personal leave, combining the sick and the vacation, whatever they're doing, they could be at a competitive disadvantage to the employers who are not. And, there's a sense of, can we, level the playing field so everyone's doing the same thing? Have you looked into that at all? Do you have any Oregon studies that talk about worker retention? I'm just curious.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek. I actually believe diametrically the opposite of what you just stated. And that is, I believe that the folks in the businesses who offer the better benefit packages that are richer, more generous, actually have first dibs on the more qualified employees. And that's how I believe the marketplace works. That's why I believe with regard to health insurance, that's the staple today. The companies that offer the best health benefits packages tend to attract the employees you want to attract. But I think that applies to That's how I believe the marketplace works. That's why I believe with regard to health insurance, that's the staple today. The companies that offer the best health benefits packages tend to attract the employees you want to attract. But I think that applies to all fringe benefits as well. In terms of studies, I don't know of any particular study to back up what I'm saying, but I'm sure as heck happy to find that.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we haven't done a study on that line, but I agree with Mr. Wilson, and the concern that I have, and I hadn't had time to get a response back from my counterpart in California, but one of the things when I initially read the bill when it came out was, will this encourage employers who currently offer a short-term disability plan to drop that plan and then move their when their employees need time off, have them go through this program as opposed to using a company-sponsored one.
This is a guilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was interested by the concern about whether or not this would require smaller employers to pay in, even though they couldn't benefit. So I went back to the beginning of the bill, and employer means a covered employer, as defined in ORS 659A-150, which promptly refers us over to 659A-153, which is the requirements apply only to employers who employ 25 or more persons in the state of Oregon for each working day. So I think that it does exclude them.
Thanks.
Representative
Ellis.
This is kind of a follow-on, because I don't think you can talk about 24-75 without touching on 85. The issue I have is that employers might begin to relook their sick leave policies, because they carry those as liabilities on their books, and some employers don't offer it because their business model doesn't allow it to keep their business alive, and employees or employers that do offer it that have a relatively generous sick leave policy, I think would seriously consider or reconsider that policy, and in fact pull back on it. That they're not going to offer sick leave like they have in the past, because it's now a mandate from the state, and so the state has now assumed a new role, which it continues, in my opinion, continues to do. And makes, in fact, it starts to spiral backwards, so that this isn't to the benefit of the employee ultimately. Any comments?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I agree. Larger companies, and if the size of the companies are coming down that do this, are looking more towards paid time off or personal time off instead of having the blocks of this is vacation and this is sick pay. Mm-hmm. But usually when they go from a separate sick pay bank and a vacation bank into a personal leave category or paid time off category, it's a fewer days than what were there originally when they had the two separate pots. So you're correct on that. And the other thing is that for employers that do have the sick leave policy and the vacation policy, a lot of them have the accrual limit based at where the long-term disability would kick in if an employee was off, and if they offer a long-term disability. So you could bank enough that if you were sick, it could get you through until the long-term disability your employer provided kicked in. And things like this, I think, it's a delicate balance, and I'm sure it will cause employers to reevaluate the benefits they're offering, the type of benefits they're offering, and the way in which they offer them.
Any further questions of these witnesses?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have three more people who have signed up. Joyce Zamanin, is that correct? Kathy Kaufman. Kevin Finney. And if anyone else wishes to testify, would you raise your hands and we'll make room for you? Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joyce Kamanen with AARP Oregon, and we are a membership organization in Oregon of people 50 and older, and we have currently slightly over 500,000 Oregonians who are members of AARP. We are testifying today in support of House Bill 2575, and we're going to take maybe a slightly different point of view than some of the other speakers going forward with it. One of the main issues for our members in this area is that they're members of the sandwich generation, and we have all heard that term, where people are still caring for children and they're also caring for elders, and they're being tugged at both directions. And we know this phenomenon is widespread in Oregon. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, I received an email from your human resources manager of DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, and she said about 40% of DEQ employees right now are baby boomers and dealing with elder care, child care, and she was looking for a speaker from us, and we are trying to find one for her, a really good one, to talk about how to manage this issue for them. So, I mean, it's a personal issue. It's a policy issue. It's widespread in Oregon. I have written testimony, so I won't give you all of the details, but AARP recently issued a report on the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act among people 50 and older, and the research shows among the public overwhelming support for this. In fact, 88% of our members are aware of it, and many of them support it even though they may not have used it. The majority of leave takers have taken no more than 4 weeks off, and they tend to take it off for family or medical, personal medical issues. But even among members 50 and older, 3% of them are taking it up to do infant care. So either they're doing baby care for their own child, grandchild, or adopted child. So it's a pretty interesting statistic. And I have the full report. If you're interested at all, I can leave it here. We do know that unpaid family leave has a disproportionate impact on women in the workforce. And I think that's where I want to address my remarks a little differently. Not just for taking time off when a baby is born, but women are the primary caregivers, unpaid caregivers in our society. And every time a woman leaves the workforce, she is putting herself more at economic risk down the road. So there are a couple ways I think that AARP looks at this. Not only is it because we are losing the economic impact for the person when they take time off, but that they're losing economic security throughout the rest of their life. In a study done by La Follette University, they found for retirement insecurity, any exodus from a paycheck for any length of time has a disparate blow to women because they're the ones primarily who take this time off. So it is a gender issue, and I think we need to be honest about that and aware of that. The other thing is that I work on workforce issues for AARP because we are wanting to make sure that people 50 and older can stay in the workforce as desired. And we know that from our research that worker shortages are going to be a fact of life in Oregon and across the nation. And we believe that policies such as this kind of position Oregon to be worker-friendly. And paid family leave provision would actually make Oregon employers more competitive, not less competitive. We know right now in Oregon, Southern Oregon and the Oregon coast is already having serious worker shortages. And I think a policy like this that is supportive of workers demonstrates to Oregon families that Oregon is a family-friendly state. So to summarize our issue, this bill, 2575, is in line with AARP policy. Our members overwhelmingly support this kind of program to support families. It helps reduce economic disparity in the workforce based on gender, and we believe it could even potentially lead to better economic security for retirees as a result. Thank you very much.
You mentioned that you had written testimony. I don't think we got that.
I heard about this while I was on vacation, and I did this on the plane flying in from my vacation this week, so I will leave it with your staff.
Thank you very much.
Would you also like a copy of the study, the national study?
That would be great.
Happy to do that, too.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Kaufman, and I'm the Policy and Communications Director for Children First for Oregon. We're a statewide child advocacy organization. We've been around for 15 years, and we are dedicated to promoting the health, safety, and security of Oregon's children. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2575. You've heard from the speakers before me that there are far too many workers who are unable to take advantage of family leave simply because they can't afford to do so. The piece that I would like to stress is the importance of House Bill 2575 to the outcomes of Oregon children. Children need parents when they're born, they need parents when they're ill, and this bill would provide more parents, especially low-income parents, the ability to stay home and care for their kids when their kids need it most. That kind of care should not be a luxury. That kind of very basic, time-limited care ought to be something that we are all entitled to, and the reason for that is not just moral. The reason for that is also it also makes economic sense. When we care for kids up front, when we provide them what they need, when we create a system that allows moms to stay home with their newborn or newly adopted children. We promote better bonding and attachment, and that in turn promotes better outcomes for kids, which in turn saves us money in the long run because those kids are more likely to grow up to become successful adults. Paid family leave matters. Paid family leave makes a difference where unpaid but job-protected leave does not. Parents of newborns who get paid leave, the children, it's associated with successful and social cognitive development. It actually decreases infant mortality, and it increases the chance that parents will be able to breastfeed, and there's no shortage of research that shows how important breastfeeding is, especially in the first 6 months to child development. This program really is a children's program. It certainly would benefit parents, but the California program on which it's modeled, 80% of the benefits went to mothers caring for newborns. So because this is such a critical time, because this bill would enable more low-income parents to stay home with their kids at this time, we urge you to support this bill. And on a closing note, I just want to say I think that the business community and all of us make a mistake when we think the needs of businesses are divorced from the needs of children. In fact, those needs are one and the same, and when kids and families get what they need, businesses are more likely to prosper. And the more we do a better job of looking at those groups together, the better off the state will be as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Finney. I'm the Public Policy Director with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon is an association of 17 Christian denominations, interfaith bodies, I meant 17 Christian denominations and many individual congregations as well. We're here this morning for a couple of reasons. First of all, as a faith organization, we support this legislation because it strengthens and supports all families, and it also speaks to our particular calling to particularly help low-income families for whom these kinds of stresses can be particularly burdensome. I also want to speak to this a little bit from a personal level. I'm a new dad. Back in July, I had my second child along with my wife, Susan. Susan's a reporter for a large, well-known newspaper here in Oregon, and they do not provide her with any kind of paid family leave benefits. She was able to take her accrued sick time and some vacation time, but she was not able to get any paid benefits. And so we had a choice to make about how quickly she would go back to work. Now, as it turned out, I was unexpectedly without work for several months this past summer and during the fall. And as much as having a child is a very joyous occasion, and it certainly has been for us, I think it's important to note that for many families, it's also a very stressful time. And that was also true for us. And we did decide to have my wife take off 3 months from work. We would have liked to have been able to have her take off more than that, but we decided that was all we could afford. And to do that, we had to really fund that time off through credit card debt. May not have been the wisest financial choice for us, and it's obviously a choice that would not be available to many working families to do, but we felt that that bonding time was very important, and particularly because in this case our child came 5 weeks early, spent a week in neonatal intensive care unit,
turned out to be perfectly healthy and very happy baby. But we felt that was a tough choice. And I think it's just important to note that for many families, this is a stressful time, and as others have spoken to, it's a very important time for that bonding in the family. And so we think it's a very important kind of approach that this bill takes. I also just want to make one other point about this, which is to say that this is an insurance program. It's an insurance program that employees pay into and therefore does not put much of a burden on businesses. We think that's a good approach. Will all employees benefit from this insurance program? No, of course they won't. That's the nature of insurance programs. The reason that costs remain low is because only a few of them take the benefits. But the fact is, you don't know as an employee whether you're going to end up needing to take advantage of a program like this. In my 20s, I did not anticipate some of the serious illnesses I would be confronted with in my 30s, out of the blue. In my 30s, I did not anticipate being a parent of two sons in my 40s. But I would have liked to have had these benefits, and I would have gladly paid 1 or even 2 cents per hour over the years to have been able to take them. So I hope you'll move forward with this legislation this session. I thank you for the time that you're spending considering this issue, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions of any of these witnesses?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just interested in the response by any of you, particularly our friends from Ecumenical and also Children First. You know, we have a problem, and it reaches a critical mass like it did in California, and we attempt to address this legislatively. But could you take a moment just to say something about your organization's advocacy besides legislative to improve the relationship between working families and employers who may not understand A, that they could save money, B, what the needs are. Just say a little bit about that. In other words, when we're trying to solve a problem, we don't want to just assume that a law is going to do it. What do we do with the constituents that you serve to improve that, or to marry them, as you say?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, I think that's an excellent question. Children First, as an advocacy group, we don't provide any direct services to families, but we do spend a great deal of time on public education, and we do our best, and we'll continue to do our best to educate the business community on where their interests and the needs of children meet. We think that a lot of the promise for the future and what can be accomplished for kids in our state and around the country lies in doing just that. So we produce regular research reports, county data books, report cards, hold forums, and do a lot of media outreach, as well as just personal relationships to make that happen.
I'm fairly new to the organization, so I'm not quite sure what the history of our activity in this area is. I certainly think it's a good suggestion, and I know that we engage in dialogue with a lot of different kinds of partners within the community, and I'll take that one to heart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to go back to the competitive advantage discussion. I think one of the reasons we're seeing the type of bills we're seeing in this committee this session is, we're trying to make Oregon a family-friendly place for employees. And, people have mentioned that it's actually an advantage to have these kind of policies to attract the right people. Now that we're in a global economy, we want the entire state to have a competitive advantage compared to other places. If we're going to recruit the best employers. Does AARP have any comments on that particular perspective on, this isn't just about how we compete inside the state anymore, it's how we compete with other states.
Well, we've done a lot of research about what employees want, and can't really tell you what makes a company competitive, but we do know what employees want. Employees want health insurance, and employees want flexibility. People over 50 really want flexibility, but the funny thing is that the 20-somethings also want flexibility. They are simply not going to ever put up with the kind of work weeks that their older predecessors did. And, it doesn't matter whether they're medical students, doctors, whatever, they're, any kind of profession, younger people want flexibility too. So
employers are going to have to offer some flexibility in these areas, and what the flexibility is time off for those personal issues that make a difference to them, and that time off to have to raise their kids, to have a baby, to take care of an elder parent. Those are critical factors in keeping people in the workforce. State of Oregon, as an employer, you guys have a critical problem because so many people are baby boomers, and fortunately the state of Oregon benefits are flexible such that people can take the time off that they need. But if workers 50 and older are going to be a major factor in keeping Oregon competitive, if we can keep them in the workforce, and for people who have the option to opt out or stay in, things such as flexible working hours and benefits are a tremendous draw to keep people working.
Thank you so much. We have one more person who wants to testify on this bill, and then we have two more bills that we're going to go through very quickly.
Thank you very much.
On the floor. Thank you very much for coming. Okay, I'm going to ask you to make it somewhat brief.
Hello. This is the first time I've ever done this, so please excuse me for the not knowing exactly how to address you. But I'm a grandmother, I'm a mother.
No, what's your name, please?
Cheryl Johns, and I wrote a letter, and I think you should have that. I've been communicating with Moms Rising, so that's what brought me here. But also, I work with Head Start for 5 years, the past 5 years, and talk about stress, financial stress. It just is amazing how it affects our families. And having a check coming in when there's some hardship on the family, like illness or a parent that is sick, for families who are struggling already with their paychecks and child care. When we had children that were coming that were sick because their moms and dads had to go off to work. So we had to send them home many times. And the families, we knew they were strapped like anything, but they had to take the day off to take care of their children. So I just want you to know that there's a lot of folks who really care about taking care of our children in Oregon and our families in Oregon to create a more humane, a more positive experience for all of us. Because I see the children, I worked in the juvenile halls as well. I taught there, and I decided to go with the younger children, in fact, because I thought that's where I could make more of a difference. But I saw the children in the juvenile halls. I taught them. They're coming from families that are so high-stressed, and they just break apart from the stress. So please, I have a lot of folks behind me that are invisible right now. So thank you for listening and for hearing. Everybody's been fantastic, so thank you.
Thank you so much for testifying. I'm going to close the public hearings on 2545 and 2485. Which one? And I'm going to open up the public hearing on 3328.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath House District 16. I wanted to thank the chair for allowing me to give a very brief overview of this bill and to explain to you what it is that we're doing here today. House Bill 3328 would modify procedures involved in child abuse investigations. This came out of a child death that happened in my legislative district about 2 years ago. You'll be receiving a newspaper article that kind of takes you through the circumstances of that case. This is a priority bill for me, but I got the bill back the day of the filing deadline, and as sometimes happens, it wasn't drafted completely consistently with what the intent of the bill was, which has caused some concern among many of the stakeholders who were there. So with the permission of the chair, what I've brought to you today are these -2 amendments, which are basically a guide
gut and stuff of the bill. And what I'm hoping that we can do is gut and stuff these so that our work group can get together and start the conversation from the basis of the intent of 3328 rather than working through some of the things that I know won't be acceptable to many of our stakeholders in the original bill as proposed. When hopefully we'll be able to come back in about 2 weeks after working with a work group and have a public hearing where we can have a much greater overview of what this bill attempts to do and what inspired it. But because I know that there are people listening across the state and there's someone here in the room, I'd like to highlight the six major changes that are in these amendments, and there are others, and to also say this is a complex bill, a work group will work, and further amendments will be made after this. The first is that as drafted, 3328 changed the definition of a child protective services worker. That is fixed in the -2 amendments and just describes someone completing a child abuse investigation as pursuant to current law. And that addresses some concerns about putting additional responsibilities on multidisciplinary teams. It also makes some clarifications in the -2 amendments around the specialized physician who would be either he or her designee seeing a child within 48 hours of injuries being observed. In the original bill, it sounded like that physician had to live in each county, and this amendment makes the clarification that each county needs to identify someone who's accessible to them. The district attorneys had made a request about chain of evidence. There are real issues now with digital photography. In the original bill, that morphed into only digital photographs could be taken. That's fixed in the -2 amendments. It just speaks more carefully to the chain of evidence around photographs, and I'll be working directly with the district attorneys to clean up that language even in the -2 amendments. And reasonable certainty is a phrase that's used in House Bill 3328 in terms of which children will see a doctor or have photographs taken. That has also been changed in this bill. The intent is that if there is a child abuse investigation, there's a report of child abuse, and a law enforcement officer or child protective service worker goes to investigate, meets the child, and the child is injured, that child will go to the doctor and have an examination by a doctor specializing in child abuse. And so the new language in the amendments are, if a person conducting an investigation described observes a child who has suffered physical injury or otherwise appears to be affected by abuse, that is then what triggers the photographs and the referral. The last major change in the -2 amendments, obviously they're substantive amendments, so there are others here. One of the primary intents of the bill initially was that when there is a fatality involving a child known to the Department of Human Services that's been the subject of an abuse investigation and they die due to abuse or neglect, that should be triggering a critical incident response team. This is not always happening. It did not happen in the case that has inspired this legislation. So the -2 amendment does include that provision that when there is a death, that will automatically by statute trigger that critical incident response team. And it also indicates that the prosecuting district attorney that's prosecuting that homicide will be consulted by that critical incident response team. I know that's a very quick overview of a very complex bill. We will be coming back to you with pretty substantive testimony from people that are very concerned about this bill. I think several of you, Representative Olson, Representative Kotek, and others who are co-sponsors of this important legislation. I'm happy to answer any brief questions about the intent of the amendments, but again, it's my hope that we can adopt these -2 amendments so that we can get the stakeholders together over the next week or two and come back to you with further proposed amendments to make this a great bill that's going to help protect our kids.
My hope today is open up a work session and move the -2 amendments, and so I prefer that we didn't have a lot of discussion because we have another bill to hear. Okay, so there will be plenty of time for discussion.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, so we can get the bill amended so it's everyone's... Okay, gotcha.
So I will entertain a motion to adopt. I'd better close the public hearing and open a work session on 3328. You move the -2 amendments?
Yes. Madam Chair, I would move adoption of the -2 amendments to House Bill 3328.
Representative Gelser moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 3328. Any objection? Any discussion? Seeing none. I will entertain a motion to adopt. I'd close the public hearing and open a work session on 3328.
Madam Chair, I would move adoption of the -2 amendments to House Bill 3328.
Representative Gelson moves the dash to amendments to House Bill 3328. Any objection? Any discussion? Seeing none, the dash to amendments are adopted, and I close the work session on House Bill 3328. And I open up the work session on 2464.
Thank you, Chair. I do have some amendments I'll share with the committee, but to summarize quickly, House Bill 2464 would direct the Department of Human Services to adopt rules to allow a person with a developmental disability receiving services to retain monthly earned income of no less than $65 and no more than $320 while maintaining eligibility for state medical assistance and placement in a residential setting. So I have the dash 2 and 3 and dash amendments, which I'll be sharing with the
Gelser. Thank you, Madam Chair. After our last hearing, some of the advocates in the Department of Human Services got together, and this is the language. The dash 2 amendments is the language that was brought back to me. What this does is it allows the Department of Human Services to apply for a waiver to be able to allow this to happen with a lesser fiscal impact. We've taken out the reference to a specific amount of money that an individual could retain because the indexing changes from year to year, and we want the ability for that income to grow and for the department to have some flexibility under that waiver. So that is what the language in the dash 2 amendment does. The dash 3 amendment provides a little bit of accountability to that, asking the department no later than January 1st of 2008 to come back to the legislature with a report on the progress of the implementation of this bill, including but not limited to a report of the number of individuals with developmental disabilities who have increased their amount of retained income and what that increase in their retained income is. Clearly, the intent of this legislation is to allow people with developmental disabilities to keep more than $65 a month of their earned income. And hopefully this reporting requirement, even though we don't list those numbers in the dash 2 amendments, will make that legislative intent clear and provide some accountability by having the department come back to us and assure us that these people are being allowed to keep more of the money that they're earning to meet their needs.
Representative, did you have invited testimony today?
I did not. However, The three folks that have worked together are here. If people have questions, they can probably answer them better than I. But I'm not seeing heads shaking yes, but people
would like to. Are you willing to have testimony from any of the stakeholders who are here who would like to testify? Seeing none. So I'm open to discussion among the committee. Where would we like to go with this?
Well, I'd like to move that we amend 2464 with the dash 2 amendments.
Representative Kotek moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2464. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None.
And then, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the dash 3 amendments to be added to 2464 as well.
Representative Kotek moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2464. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. All right, those two amendments pass. Representative Gelser.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move that the committee move House Bill 2464 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee by prior referral with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves House Bill 2464 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior referral.
Madam Chair? Apparently there is not a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that has been assigned. So can I amend my motion?
Please do.
I would like to move House Bill 2464 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Wonderful.
Come on, maybe.
Madam Chair.
Wait, did you have a conversation
about
revenue?
Right, but it's not here.
Okay, maybe it was...
Maybe you're not aware of any other...
I had thought that there had been a...
We'll just discuss the chair. It's not in the system. It's not sure if I did any subsequent actions. The department has
subsequent actions, meaning?
The speaker is labeled. I don't think they did, but we'll just clarify to make sure. I seem
to have this in my file, which would suggest a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. That's what should happen. So,
All right. May I please amend my motion again?
I would move House Bill 2464 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee by letter.
Reference from the Speaker.
Would it be past recommendation?
I don't know what we're doing.
Well, I signed it.
Correct. This was the request of the Speaker, and the Speaker approved it.
Okay. So, Representative Gelson.
Yes.
Do you want to take a break?
Could we take a 2-minute break?
Yes.
We'll take a 5-minute break.
Wait, somebody wishes to
Just for the record, Brian Weishman, representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. This bill, as introduced last session, went directly from committee to the full floor in the House with an anticipation that as it worked its way through, if it needed to hit Ways and Means, it would hit on the backside, on the Senate side. So just to give you a little history, there is a process in which that's happened previously. The interesting question about this bill, the way it's designed, is it really a Ways and Means issue because it's not an expenditure of dollars. It's a lessening of revenue coming in, so perhaps it really is a revenue question rather than the Ways and Means question. But at the same time, even with the federal, the amendment to the federal waiver is a lessening of dollars that are revenue into SPD. So they would need in their budget, if this were to pass, a backfill of some dollars. But this bill itself does not require an allocation of dollars in itself. So it's up to you as to how you want to handle it, whether you want to send it to Ways and Means, but there is not an allocation of dollars with this bill. It's just the fact that SPD is going to collect less dollars because they're not requiring these folks to pay on their income.
Thank you very much, Brian. Appreciate that. Colleagues, we're going to take a 5-minute recess and we'll go to the speaker's office and determine what exactly we need to do.
That's right.